I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, I talk with Nicole Hobbs of Every District.
Isn't that nice?
I've been focusing a lot on state legislative races recently because I think it's an overlooked part of the work that needs to be done by Democrats to regain some legislative balance in the country, to move progressive legislation forward, and of course, to put a stop to extreme gerrymandering. And that's where today's guest comes in. Nicole Hobbs joins me from everydistrict.us, and that's an organization that aims to rebuild the Democratic Party by winning power back at the state level. And they're doing this with better data and with new approaches to fundraising. In this conversation, Nicole breaks down exactly where we need to win races and why. She also talks about why and how we lost those seats in the first place. So here is my conversation with Nicole Hobbs. Nicole Hobbs, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm honored to be able to join today.
So there's been a lot of focus on partisan gerrymandering lately, and I think everyone is probably familiar with what that is right now because, you know, people are talking about it ad nauseum, right? But just in case, I'll just explain it. It's, you know, when one party manipulates the boundaries of an electoral district to favor their party over another. And Republicans have been really, really good at that, or really, really bad at it. I mean, they've been good at you know, favoring their party, but it's really hurt some Democratic races. And the thing is that a lot of Dems, you know, strategists and politicians have just started to wake up to the fact that this is happening, A, and the fact that it's the state legislative races and those seats that actually control these district boundaries. But the thing is, and I guess my question to you, because this is where your org comes in, you know, now the Democrats have had a minute to think about this and to react and to focus on these state legislative races. They don't seem to have acted quickly enough, right? I mean, we had a chance in 2018 and we kicked butt, you know, in the House and won lots of congressional seats, but we didn't win a lot of state legislative races in 2018. What happened?
Great question. So I serve as the executive director of Every District, and our exclusive focus is working in the states. We identify competitive state legislative districts and where Democrats have an opportunity to flip a chamber, and we support Democratic candidates running in those competitive districts, primarily with fundraising. We've been involved in six states since 2017. So we started in Virginia in 2017, and last year we were in five states: Arizona, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And Democrats netted about 300 seats in the states last year, which is no small feat. There were some bright spots that we saw. But Democrats lost almost 1,000 state legislative seats during the Obama years, so we still have a steep hole to climb out of. And we recently did an analysis of what we saw happen in 2018 at the state legislative level, and one of the biggest problems that we saw was in fundraising and still the lack of funding that is going to state legislative candidates running in competitive districts. And this is something Democrats really need to figure out before the 2020 election if we're going to make a serious dent in Republicans' power at the state level.
I just want to point out, you know, one of the facts that you mentioned, just the stark difference between 2008 and now. Like in 2008, Democrats actually controlled both houses of the state legislature in 27 states.
That's correct.
And now it's like, I think it's what, how many? 13 now?
So right now, so following the 2016 election, Democrats' power in the states had dropped to only controlling both houses of the state legislature in 12 states. So from 27 states to 12 states. Because of the 300 seats we netted in 2018, we've bounced back a little bit. So now Democrats control both houses of the state legislature in 18 states. But Republicans still control both houses of the state legislature in 30 states. So there's still way too many states out there where Republicans have control at all levels of government at the state level.
Right. But here's the thing. So a lot of those unfair maps that Republicans drew up, you know, sometime between 2008 and now are still in place. And Republicans are still flipping some of these blue seats to red, right?
Exactly. So one under-talked about aspect of 2018 is Democrats had a gain of 300 seats in the state. We actually flipped well over 400 seats, but Republicans flipped about 100 seats last year. So that's where we we get this 300 net gain of seats. Republicans by no means have given up on the states. And really, the maps that they were able to put in place in 2010 have allowed them to hold on to power in a way that is unprecedented in the history of state legislative elections.
So when you're on the ground, what's the difference in those races? You know, taking 2018, for instance, where a Democratic candidate won their race, you know, in comparison to someone who did not win their race?
So one of the biggest differences that we saw between successful and unsuccessful candidates in 2018 was in fundraising. Because fundraising, it's the foundation on which a campaign is built. Fundraising means that candidates can hire the staff to do outreach to voters, can be able to build a volunteer program, to be able to make phone calls, knock on doors, to be able to do the necessary communications outreach, whether that's sending mail or running digital ads. Fundraising is the foundation. We endorsed 62 candidates across the five states we worked in 2018. And while our successful candidates were still outraised, they were only outraised on average by $20,000. So they kept it close. Our unsuccessful candidates were outraised on average by $250,000. And that's the gap that we have to figure out how to fill in 2020. And we saw a real difference in what successful campaigns were able to do versus what unsuccessful campaigns were able to do based off of these fundraising numbers. Our successful campaigns were able to knock 33% more doors because of the extra resources they had. So this lack of fundraising is really putting candidates at a disadvantage. And we have to figure out how to close this gap if we're going to flip more seats in 2020.
Do you know what's at the root of that fundraising deficit? Is it because of the districts that they're in, or is it just because of familiarity with these races, you know, marketing? What is it?
There are a couple of different factors that come into play. Our candidates who were successful in 2018 tended to be running in more Democratic-leaning districts. So these were the districts where it was easier for us to flip in 2018. So they got more attention from outside groups like us and also from in-state actors like the state party or the state caucus. Their focus is on figuring out which districts are most easiest for Democrats to win back and concentrating resources there. And given the hole that we were in some of these states, it was hard to have enough resources to spread around. So the resources concentrated in the easy places. Our unsuccessful candidates tended to be running in districts that we like to call the more pink districts, so districts that fundamentally lean Republican, but are still districts that Democrats have to win if we're going to flip these chambers. These are still the least Republican-leaning districts where Democrats have the best chance of getting to a flip. And so I think the challenge in 2020 is going to be getting enough resources to state legislative candidates to protect the gains that we made in 2018 and be able to get the necessary resources to candidates running in these pink districts in 2020.
Right. So it's not just about winning more of these state legislative seats. It's about winning and then retaining the ones that we've already won. And then also, you know, somehow put a stopgap between Republicans, you know, flipping more seats, right? It just seems like whack-a-mole.
It does. It does. It's, you know, you solve one problem and more pop up. But the thing is, this is doable. I think one of the reasons why Democrats were so successful in flipping the House in 2018 was money. We saw these third quarter financial reports where you had so many Democratic congressional candidates outraising their Republican opponents. We didn't see that at the state legislative level. So this is possible. It's just going to take us as a party coming together and saying that, yes, we can focus on the presidential election and getting Trump out of the White House and electing a Democrat. We can focus on competitive Senate races. We can protect our House majority. And we can make sure that we're getting resources to state legislative candidates. These goals aren't mutually exclusive, but we as a party have to be able to figure out how to do all of these things at the same time, because Republicans figured this out years ago.
Yeah, we're at least least a decade behind.
Definitely. Definitely.
In responding to this. And I just want to go back to basics for a bit because, so here's how I feel. So I know that everybody's thinking about the 2020 race. Everyone's watching the debates. They're watching the dim candidates. You know, they're watching Trump's tweets every day. So I don't think that there is going to be a problem with Democratic turnout for the 2020 presidential race, right?
I would agree.
Yeah. But so this is why I wanted to talk to you and I wanted to talk to a lot of people about these state legislative races, because this is about a long-term direction for Democrats, right?
Exactly.
So I guess my basic question is, and this is something that I need, and I think a lot of people, a lot of listeners probably need a basics civics refresher around this. What are these seats, essentially? Like, what seats are we talking about when we talk about state legislative seats that we need to win to help redraw these districts?
So we've identified about 220 districts that if Democrats can win these seats would fundamentally alter the balance of power at the state legislative level. And these seats are in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, to name just a few. We've also got states on the list like Georgia, Texas, Arizona, all states that matter for the presidential election. So we don't have to take resources from a state that's really important to winning the presidency and put it elsewhere. All we have to do is make sure that resources that we're putting into these states are not only focusing on the top of the ticket, but also at the bottom of the ticket. And this was really a phenomenon that we saw in 2017 in Virginia, was all of these very active House of Delegate campaigns that were happening there increased the vote share at the top of the ticket. If you go back and look at how the governor's race played out in Virginia in 2017 versus 2013. So by investing in state legislative races in these key states, we can help bolster the overall vote share for all of the candidates on the ticket, as opposed to detracting from efforts that would otherwise be going to helping whoever the Democratic nominee for president ends up being.
Right. So I just want to ask another basic question about fundraising. So is it a matter of, you know, a Democrat running in a district where there just aren't enough blue-leaning constituents to contribute? Or is it about outside money, getting enough attention to get outside money? Or is it a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both. And certainly what we've seen over the past 2 years in the successes that we've seen at the state legislative level, fundraising both within district, within state, and out of state has been key for the candidates who have been successful. So take Virginia in 2017. We worked with a lot of local grassroots groups in Virginia and in the kind of DC and Maryland area as well, who were energized by the 2016 presidential election and got involved to support these candidates in 2017 in a way that many of them had never supported a local candidate like that before. And those groups were really instrumental to what happened in 2017 in Virginia. But we also saw various national groups get involved and outside money come into the state. So both has to happen. I think in these key states that we're looking at in 2019 and 2020, there certainly are resources in these states that can help these candidates, but getting resources from out of state will be key to in making sure that candidates have the proper funding to be able to do the basics of campaigning.
So I just want to go back to gerrymandering for just a second, because I just want to just point out for people or just paint a picture of what actually happens in these extremely gerrymandered districts. So in some cases, and I can't remember what state this happened in or which states it happened in, it's probably more than one, where a Democratic candidate will win, you know, over 50% of the vote and end up with around 40% of the seats. So that's what happens in these unfairly drawn district maps, right?
Yes. So there are so many reasons why Democrats need to win back state houses across the country by 2020. Gerrymandering is the main reason why this 2020 deadline is so important. In 2010, when Republicans were locked out of power in DC, they developed Project Red Map, which was their program to invest resources in key state legislative districts, flip these districts, and gain control in state houses across the country. But what was so problematic about that was not the kind of red wave that happened in the states in 2010, but that that gave Republicans power in a key year to be able to redraw the lines. And so this is what's made it so much harder for Democrats to win back power in the states over the past few years. And we saw in 2018 what this means. There were states like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, where Democrats won the popular vote, but did not win a majority of state legislative seats. I mean, I think it should be easy for people to agree that the party who wins the most votes in state legislative races should end up with more than 50% of the seats. But that's not what we're seeing given the way that lines have been drawn. And if you'd like to take a look at some crazy districts, we have a map on our website. You can go to everydistrict.us, click on various states, and you can see these crazy looking districts that Republicans have drawn in states across the country that really make no sense other than keeping pockets of Republican voters together so Republicans are able to lock in their power even when the majority of voters in that state aren't electing Republicans at the state legislative level. So that's what it means for gerrymandering. But there are also policy implications. I mean, we've seen with all of these heartbeat bills, so-called heartbeat bills that have sprung up in state capitals across the country earlier this year, that policy that happens at the state level is really important. I think for too long, Democrats have focused their efforts on enacting policy at the federal level. And of course, that's important. But there are ways for the states to either take actions that are helpful or harmful on various policy matters that are important to Democrats. And we've seen how Republicans have been slowly eroding a woman's right to choose in various states across the country. So Roe v. Wade may be the law of the land, but based on the decisions made by Republican legislators in your state capital, there may or may not be a clinic where a woman can go to in that state to get an abortion, or she may have to travel several hours to be able to access the one abortion clinic that is still open. And so, you know, we can talk about various issues. Abortion is just one of them, but this is an example of how states under Republican control are able to chip away at certain issues that we might think are protected by federal policy.
Right. And you were also telling me about a case or talking about a case when we talked offline that happened in Virginia following the mass shooting in Virginia Beach. I think that happened in spring, a little earlier this year, and how they called a special legislative session and the fact that Republicans controlled that state, how it affected gun policy. Can you talk a bit about that story?
Definitely. So this spring, there was a mass shooting in Virginia Beach, and it happened, I would say, just after the legislative session had concluded. And so the governor called a special session, which is within his power to do, and said, you know, legislators, I need you to come back to Richmond. We have this tragedy that happened in our state, and I need you to respond to it. And we've also seen poll after poll that has shown that a majority of Virginians support common sense gun safety legislation. So legislators came back to Richmond for the special session, and this happened a couple of weeks ago. And they were various legislators. There were Democratic legislators and Republican legislators who had put forth various proposals for steps that Virginia could take, laws that could be passed in this special session that would make progress on gun safety. And the session ended up lasting about 90 minutes before Republicans, who still have the majority in the Virginia legislature, convened the session without even discussing a single policy measure, which is disgraceful. And so this is just another example of what we're seeing when Republicans are in control of the states.
Right. And I think in that same session, Republicans said something that they wanted to refer all of these bills to a bipartisan commission for study and recommendation, and that it was premature to actually talk about, you know, passing any bills to address this.
Yes. So they have said that they will have this commission and they will reconvene conveniently on November, I believe, 18th, which is after the competitive state legislative election season that we're seeing in Virginia, to debate what should be done. But it's clear what needs to happen. Virginia has very lax gun laws. There are very simple steps that legislators in Virginia could take to implement common sense gun safety legislation, and Republicans have no interest in doing so. I have no faith that, you know, whether or not Republicans end up in control after the November elections, if Republicans are in control, we will not see any progress come out of the session on November 18th. That's very clear. If Virginians want gun safety reform, then their only option is to elect a Democratic majority in November, which we are working on doing, and we hope to see on election night in Virginia.
Yeah, and another important piece of policy is the Equal Rights Amendment, which I didn't actually realize this until reading about it, that it was first proposed in 1923. Right. And it was, I think, passed by Congress in 1972, mm-hmm. and it's been ratified by 37 states. So it's just one state short of being ratified under the Constitution, I think, one or two states that, short.
It's one state short. Yes.
One state. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So as you just said, the Equal Rights Amendment, it needs one more state to ratify it in order to pass. And Virginia could be that state. And there were people in Virginia who worked really hard to make Virginia the final state needed for ratification. But again, what we saw from Republicans in the Virginia legislature was it did pass the Senate. And the Equal Rights Amendment got some Republican votes in the Senate. So credit where credit's due, there were some Republican legislators in the Senate who voted for it. The House is a different story. In the House, partisan control currently sits at 49 Democrats and 51 Republicans. And there was only one Republican Virginia legislator who voted for it. And Republicans did all of these procedural tricks. Republicans in leadership in particular made sure that the Equal Rights Amendment did not pass the legislature this session. And this is just another example of this should be a common sense thing for legislators to pass, saying we want equal rights for women. But apparently that is too controversial for Republican legislators in Virginia. And they've made clear that the only way we can get the Equal Rights Amendment passed is with a Democratic majority in the legislature.
Well, I mean, how could you not vote for the Equal Rights Amendment?
It's pretty crazy. And I mean, this would be something that if we can elect a Democratic majority in Virginia in November, this is something that can happen. Democrats have said they will vote for it. This is a clear policy outcome that we could get as a result of the elections in November if Democrats are able to take control of the chamber, which is just one of the many reasons why we are working so hard to make sure that happens. One note I will make is that I believe that the window that was initially allotted by Congress, given that the Equal Rights Amendment came out of Congress in the 70s, has passed. So even if Virginia were to ratify it in, say, you know, early 2020 in this new legislative session, we would still have to go back to Congress to try to retroactively extend that window. But that's what activists have been pushing for, is get it passed by the Virginia legislature with a Democratic majority and then be able to go back and get that window retroactively extended so the Equal Rights Amendment can pass.
Right. And I just want to restate this. It was first proposed in 1923, you know, almost a century ago. Mm-hmm. Right. And I believe that it's the second longest pending bill ever in history. And this is the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's true. So what should we be doing? I know that you have a few projects that are pending or that are in the works, right? You have the Purple State Project. Tell me about that.
We do. So really the reason why we started Every District in early 2017 was after the 2016 election, like a lot of people, Every District's co-founders were trying to figure out something that we could do. We all had a background in local politics and campaigns and wanted to help candidates who were running in Virginia in 2017. And the biggest problem that we had was we couldn't find anyone who could tell us where there actually were competitive state legislative districts in Virginia, let alone in any other state around the country. So as a result of that, we've built the Every District map, which you can find by going to our website, everydistrict.us, and it's right on our homepage. And this map shows the competitiveness of every state legislative district across the country. So I encourage you to go to our website, click on a state, and take a look at our district-by-district analysis that we've done for each state. And what this map shows is exactly what Democrats need to do over the next 2 years to fundamentally alter the balance of power in the states. In August, we'll be releasing what we call our Purple States Report that will shine the spotlight on the 220 or so districts that are key for Democrats to win to rebuild power in the states. And we'll have more information about exactly where those districts are and what those districts look like. Because again, this is what we're finding to be a really understudied area, is figuring out who the voters actually are in these districts and what will convince them to vote for a Democratic state legislative candidate. Thanks to gerrymandering, we know that the vast majority of these districts are Republican leaning. And so we have to figure out how we can put together coalitions of voters in these individual districts around the country that will vote for a Democratic state legislative candidate so we can get to enough flips to be able to flip a chamber. And so that's really what our Purple State Project takes a look at. And this year, we are in Virginia and Mississippi, where there are important state legislative elections there. And we have, if you go to our website, there are specific things that you can do to get involved to directly support candidates in Virginia and Mississippi this year as well.
What I find really encouraging about Democrats is that once they know about a problem, I feel like they go all in to try to fix it, right? And I think we saw that in the 2018 midterms, where we wanted to win those congressional seats and there was this huge wave and we did it. And so that's the encouraging thing. I feel like if the word gets out about these state legislative races and where we need to focus our money and our energy and our time, I think that we can do this.
Exactly, exactly. And especially in Virginia, we've talked a lot about the policy implications of what flipping the Virginia legislature would mean. But to talk a minute about, you know, what's actually happening on the ground, Democrats only need to flip 2 seats in the state house and 2 seats in the state Senate to get to a majority in the Virginia legislature. And many of you may remember in 2017, Democrats flipped 15 seats in the Virginia House. And our data analysis shows that flipping these 2 seats is eminently doable. We actually think that Democrats can flip as many as 11 or 12 seats in the state House and 5 or 6 seats in the state Senate, which would give Democrats not just a majority, but a commanding majority to be able to enact the policy change that Virginians have been asking for years now. And if you're interested in getting involved to directly support candidates in Virginia, if you go to our website, you can find several things to do. You can donate directly to candidates in Virginia. So if you make a donation through our Virginia Donate button, that money isn't going to every district. It's going directly to the candidates who we've endorsed, where your dollars can be put to best use. We also have options for you to volunteer. You can sign up through our Mobilize link. Mobilize, if you're not familiar with it, is a great resource to be able to find volunteer opportunities for candidates, and they make it really easy for you to directly sign up with a campaign to knock on doors or make phone calls. And there are also remote opportunities. So if you don't live in Virginia, you can still get involved and do phone banking for candidates from anywhere across the country. And you can also fundraise. Fundraising is one of the main ways that we support candidates who we endorse. And we have a very specific idea of how Democrats can improve the way we do fundraising. And we call this our peer-to-peer fundraising model, where we train activists on how to be effective fundraisers and raise small to medium-sized dollars directly for the state legislative candidates that we endorse.
Right. I know we talked about this offline as well. I signed up for your fundraising champion model.
Yes.
Because like you said at the beginning of our conversation, that fundraising was the biggest difference between candidates who won their races in 2018 and candidates who didn't.
So this is a program that we've put together to make fundraising accessible for everyone. I think everyone who has ever given to a Democratic candidate is familiar with what we call the emails, where it's, you know, Nancy Pelosi yelling at you for $5 and saying, if you don't give this $5, Democrats are going to lose the House and it will be your fault and yours alone. And I mean, this fundraising works, right? We get these emails because it is effective. And maybe you give because you're scared and you don't want to be the one person who causes us to lose our House majority in 2020, but it doesn't build the party in a productive way. You give out of fear, not because you're motivated to do so for a positive reason. So our goal with our Fundraising Champion program is to make fundraising a positive experience for people who go through our program and to really turn fundraising into an organizing model where we can use fundraising to both give activists who've, you know, for a long time knocked on doors and made phone calls a new tool for their toolkit. We can teach them also how to be effective fundraisers. And for people who've never been involved in politics before, this can be a way for them to get involved in the political process. We've had fundraisers go through our program who've said, I cannot stand the thought of calling a stranger or knocking on the door of a stranger and asking them to, you know, who they're planning on voting for. But, you know, I can email five of my friends who I know are Democrats and who I feel pretty confident would give money if I asked them to. So for some people, this can be an easier lift than for others. And that's really the goal, is to make fundraising accessible for a broader group of folks than we've previously seen.
Right. I just have this image that I can't get out of my head. I just realized that I'm not on Nancy Pelosi's email list when you said that, because I've never seen one of these emails. But, you know, whatever she's doing, she used all caps. I'm not really sure how she does this email yelling, but, you know, it worked in 2018.
It did. It did. I mean, that's the thing. It's really effective, but not always, you know, doesn't always make you feel good at the end of the day.
Well, but the more the merrier, right? Like if I'm raising money here and Nancy Pelosi is sending you these threatening emails, you know, it's more money in the end, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, I think, for people who haven't been engaged in fundraising before, our model of engaging people in the fundraising process by having a friend bringing them in is a, in some ways, more high touch ask. You know, it's a friendly person who's asking you for $5. It's your neighbor, it's your coworker, it's a member of your family. And so for people who haven't given before, haven't been interested in giving to candidates before, sometimes it takes that personal touch to convince them to get involved.
So from now on, my mantra between now and 2020, every day when I wake up, I'm going to say Virginia, Virginia, Virginia.
Yes, that's what everyone should say when they wake up every morning. That is my morning routine. I say Virginia, 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 Mississippi, and then I get started with my day.
Perfect. But it's not just Virginia, right? Mississippi is one of your target states. So why is that?
So in Mississippi, this is a different type of state for us in that Democrats getting to a majority either in the House or the Senate is definitely an uphill climb. However, if Democrats can flip two seats in the Senate and two seats in the House, they can break the Republican supermajorities in both of those chambers, which would be important for one main reason, which is that in Mississippi, budget bills have to be approved by a supermajority in both chambers. So if Democrats can break the current Republican supermajority, they'll have a really important seat at the table in determining funding priorities for Mississippi over the next 4 years. So that means a conversation about Medicaid expansion is on the table. That means more leverage for additional funding for public schools, additional funding for infrastructure. And I'll say, in terms of infrastructure in Mississippi, I took a trip down there earlier this year and got a flat tire because of a massive pothole. So I feel personally invested now in improving Mississippi's infrastructure. You know, these issues are important. We also saw a study that just came out that showed that states that have not expanded Medicaid, there have been people who died in those states from a lack of access to care. And had those states expanded Medicaid, those folks would have had access to healthcare that maybe could have helped them catch a problem earlier, and might have resulted in a different outcome for them. So when we talk about Medicaid expansion and what it means for people to have access to healthcare, this study shows that we're literally talking about life and death. And this is what it means for Mississippi. Medicaid expansion, additional funding for public schools, or Mississippi has historically been at the bottom of the list in terms of the amount of money that states are investing in their public schools and investments in infrastructure. And our data analysis shows that the districts are there. We've endorsed several candidates in Mississippi. And in the same way that we have ways for you to get involved to support our candidates in Virginia, we also have ways for you to get involved to support our candidates in Mississippi by donating and fundraising and volunteering.
Right. So I'm still going to be obsessively thinking about Virginia and Mississippi and doing whatever I can between now and 2020. But, you know, let's be real for a second. I mean, I know that fundraising was the biggest difference in your research and your studies. But Beto O'Rourke, just to use an example, in Texas, raised a ton of money and still could not flip that seat.
That is true.
What are we really up against? Maybe there is no answer for that.
I have a couple of answers. So I think one thing, and this goes back a little bit to our Purple States project, is yes, there were some candidates who we've worked with over the past 2 years who raised more money than their opponent, who knocked on more doors and made more phone calls than their opponent, and they still lost. So in some of these districts, and in particular these really pink districts that I was talking about that we have to win but are very Republican leaning in order to get to a flip in some of these chambers, you can raise all the money, you can knock on all the doors, but there may still be an element that's missing. And that's really having an understanding of the voters in these districts and what they care about. And I think that's still an understudied topic at the state legislative level. Now, I'm not an expert in what did or didn't happen in Texas and who Beto's messaging did or did not bring in as a result of that campaign. But I think if I would say there, you know, there are kind of three really key things that Democrats need to do over the next 2 years in order to flip these state houses, it's dollars, it's doors, and it's messaging. And messaging is really that key third piece that I think is going to be the secret sauce in quite a few of these races that we have to figure out and we have to get right if Democrats are going to make a dent in Republican power at the state level.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a campaign that I supported during the 2018 midterms in Mississippi. And that was Mike Epsi's campaign for Senate there. And again, you know, he was running against a really problematic Republican candidate, Cindy Hyde-Smith. She was really problematic. And, you know, listeners can look her up if they want, but she really needed to lose that race. But it was Mike Epsi that lost the race instead, you know, and I donated to his campaign. He seemed to have a lot of momentum behind his campaign. I mean, there was a lot of celebrity attention to it, you know, but he still lost, right? And I'm just not sure how to win in deep, deep red districts. And I guess that's what your org is doing. But, you know, at this rate, I'm going to have to mortgage my house.
So to make you potentially feel a little bit better about the SB campaign, SB did raise a ton of money, especially by Mississippi standards. However, most of that money came in a very short window of time after the general election when they had the runoff. Mississippi has some very strange election laws, this runoff law being one of the more less strange laws that they have. But SB saw the bulk of his money basically in like a 3-week period. And so when you've haven't been able to raise a ton of money because, you know, within the U.S. Senate landscape, Mississippi is not a top target. They're really, you know, his campaign hadn't been able to, I think, lay the groundwork to effectively build a coalition to be able to get to a win. Now, had he had that money earlier, had that money come, you know, in May, in July, or even in September, I think there could have been more done that might have been able to get him to a win. And so this is another kind of issue that we've seen at the state level, is even in races where money ends up making it to candidates, if the vast majority of money is coming in October, there's only so much that candidates can spend that money on. By, you know, if you're giving in October, please still give to candidates. There are things that they can do to spend your money. But this is another problem that we as Democrats have, is, you know, it gets super close to election day and we say, oh my gosh, all these candidates are behind in fundraising. We need to raise a bunch of money for them so that they can, you know, have the money that they need in order to win on election day. But really, they need this money early so that they can hire campaign staff and start putting these, you know, pieces of campaign infrastructure together to be able to do the necessary organizing throughout the summer and into the fall. And so this is another challenge that we've been working on, is figuring out ways to get money to candidates earlier so that they can build out their infrastructure earlier.
Right. That's a really important lesson. So I think our presidential candidates for now will be fine. I think a lot of people are focusing, you know, their efforts, their fundraising efforts and their money and their resources on giving to their favorite primary candidate, which is fine. But I just would advise to not to forget about these state races. And your org is a great place to find out what state races, Virginia and Mississippi for now, that you should focus on.
Thank you. Yes. So if you have questions, visit everydistrict.us. We also love to hear from people. So if you have questions about state legislative races or how you can put your money or time to best use, send me an email at nicole@everydistrict.us and let's chat.
Wow, you gave your email address out on...
We like to hear from people.
Nicole Hobbs, thank you so, so much for joining me. And thank you for your work. And I will be signing up, or I already signed up.
So I'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. And one of the things that most people don't know about the electorate is that it's independently produced and we have a very, very small budget. I, Jen Taylor Skinner, you know, I do all of the recording myself. I do the production work and I do the audio editing. I even do my own graphics and social media. Yeah, I wear a lot of hats. So with that in mind, please consider supporting the electorate in one of the following ways. Leave a review on iTunes. It's really simple. Just go under the ratings and review tab and click leave a review. It helps boost our rankings and it helps other podcast listeners discover us. Secondly, if you haven't subscribed, please do so. That's also easy and it's free. Just go to the electorate page on your favorite podcast platform and hit the subscribe button. Lastly, please consider becoming a supporter of the electorate on Patreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can help me produce more quality shows like the one you've just heard today. And that's at patreon.com/electorate. And I'll put that link in the show notes. And you know what? I just really appreciate your listening today. Knowing that someone's out there listening to this podcast, it gives me confidence to keep going. So thank you so much. Thank you so much again for listening. And until next time, keep up the good fight.